Happy Pride Month! Hello and welcome to Crying in the Book Club, the hit new podcast where three emotional friends talk about comic books that make them emotional. I am Panda slash Emily. I am your host. I said Panda because I'm used to introducing myself that way, but I don't actually say that on this show. So here we are. Hi, I'm Emily. I'm here with John Luke. Hi, John Luke.
Hello. You're allowed to go by whatever you want on the show.
I am. I just historically have not. So
it's true.
I just introduced myself that way by habit and then realized that that was not correct. And I'm also here with Chad. Hi, Chad.
Hello.
And we may or may not have Alex here at some point, but we are here for Pride Month. Last year in Pride Month.
Every month is Pride Month.
Every month is Pride Month for me, but
we're always celebrating LGBTQ people.
Honestly. But last year during Pride Month, I feel like the choices I made were very, very safe, very educational, and this year I've decided to choose violence, and that includes reading The Pervert by Michelle Perez and Remy Boydell, a book that everyone else had read, but not me. So I'm excited to get into it. The Pervert is a queer and trans graphic novel written by Michelle Perez, illustrated by Remy Boydell. Excerpts of this book were originally published in the Eisner-nominated anthology Island, which I say that because it is it's all in caps, so I have to assume I'm supposed to yell it. The book was intended to be published in its entirety over the course of Island, but the anthology ended before this could happen. The Pervert was published in May of 2018. Elements of the book are semi-autobiographical, but this is not a memoir. Certain scenes are very close to reality, but most are composite. So the Pervert is a collection of vignettes centered around the experiences of a transgender sex worker living in Seattle, Washington. The story follows Felina, unnamed until close to the very end of the book, a trans woman from Michigan who uses sex work to pay for her hormone replacement therapy medication. We meet various characters in and out of Felina's life, from partners to clients and somewhere in between. After Felina's struggle for survival worsens and worsens, she makes the difficult decision to return home to Michigan and live with her estranged father. I could have potentially gone into more specific detail about The Pervert, but dreamlike is maybe the way that I would describe the experience of reading The Pervert, I guess, probably owing to the watercolor nature of Remy Boydell's art. It feels very, I don't know, there's a certain quality about it, but I quite enjoyed this book. So I am wondering, because everyone else in this episode had read The Pervert before I did, before I even picked it for this, because I had heard of it because of the previous iteration of this show, and I knew instinctively that it would make a good Pride Month book, but I had not read it, so I am wondering what was you guys' previous experience with reading The Pervert?
Well, you have to understand that 2018 feels like two decades ago because of COVID.
Sure.
So I went into this going, oh, I remember really liking this. I don't remember almost anything about it.
Uh-huh.
I had actually reviewed it for the old website, and I reread my review, and I was like, hey, that was a pretty good review by me. Go me. The score got removed.
I was supposed to read your review before this episode, and I didn't do that.
That's okay. It didn't jog my memory a whole lot. So rereading it was interesting because everything was familiar, but it was also like for a split second new. And then you're like, oh yeah, it's this bit. Oh yeah, it's this bit. But there's that little like little dopamine rush of like, what's going to happen next? I don't know. And I like the first two thirds of this comic a lot. Mm-hmm. I have issues with the last third. I don't know if they bother me more now than they did then. It's hard to tell. It's an interesting kind of narrative in that it's very slice of life, but just when I think slice of life, I think of like K-On! Or Seinfeld, you know, those two very similar shows.
Very lighthearted.
So to have a slice of life about a struggling character who is a sex worker is kind of cool. I mean, it's like taking the genre and flipping it around and adding a kind of atmosphere and a tone to it that you don't normally expect from the genre. Mm-hmm. So I do really appreciate the kind of transgressive element to it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a point I'm leading to. So Jean-Luc, if you want to talk.
Well, you know, I simply thought it could have been good, but the art is shit and the dialogue is seriously lacking. The premise was decent, and it could have been a really good look at what being a sex worker is like, but it focused too much on the actual sex and the author having a pity party for themselves throughout. So don't buy like wasting money.
I assume that you're quoting Chad Waller's review for
No. I'm quoting because I went back and I listened. Chad went back and read his review. I also reread Chad's review, but I also went back and listened to the episode of the old podcast that we did where we talked about. And Chad made an offhand comment that on Comic Book Roundup, the user average was a 2 for this book. And so I went and was like, I want to see what the Comic Book Roundup users were saying about it. I like, you know, in the same way that for the Runaways, I was reading old forum posts.
I love that though.
I don't believe that. I really liked The Pervert the first time that I read it, also back in 2018. It was interesting going back and listening.
Listeners can't tell that like the entire time that Jean-Luc was saying all of his like lead up, I was like flipping him off towards the camera. I just need to make sure that was part of the audio experience as well as the visual experience for us at hand.
It was a similar experience to Chad rereading it because like I obviously remember liking it. I remember what it like was about, and also when I read it, I had no idea who either Michelle Perez or Remy Boydell was, and now I feel like I can't go 2 weeks without seeing a Remy Boydell tweet reposted into my Twitter feed.
That's probably my fault. So,
you and various other people that I follow, which is not a bad thing. I mean, I do really like the art in this book, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember in 2018. Now it's interesting reading it because it feels way more... Well, I guess it feels less, not that it isn't transgressive, but it feels less transgressive now. Getting this in like a Dropbox folder from Image Comics in 2018 and reading it was like, oh, wow. I remember that feeling of reading it and just feeling like it was very different from every other comic that I was reading at the time, which was sort of supposed to be the conceit of the Island anthology, but, you know, like...
Yeah,
I had stopped reading Island before the pervert started showing up there. So I hadn't read it before the actual graphic novel came out. But yeah, I still really like it. It wasn't the similar experience of like, as soon as I would see a character on the screen, it's like, on the page, I was like, oh, I remember this scene. Mm-hmm. Like that whole bit where he's talking to the Clifford looking dog, who's Canadian.
Yeah.
As they were going through that scene, as I was reading through that scene, I was like, oh, I remember this, like, there being this bit about this guy being Canadian. But if you'd asked me, you know, 2 weeks ago before I reread it, like, I wouldn't have been able to tell you about that. So it was good to revisit it because I don't think I've read, like, I read this when it came out and then I reread it when I bought the trade. But I don't think I've read it in probably over probably 5 or 6 years at this point. So,
yeah. As I said, the The Pervert was originally intended to serialize throughout the life of Island, but Island outlived the Pervert, it seems. So the Pervert got its own graphic novel release, which I'm grateful for, because that is how I read this.
It also puts into perspective sort of the structure of the Pervert.
Yeah,
it does have, like,
yeah,
the you mentioned the vignette structure, right? But mm-hmm. each of the
and we'll get more into that for
sure.
But yeah, I find the vignette structure to be very interesting, and I also will be interested in hearing about your opinions on it. But one of the things that I want to know about y'all's feelings on the Pervert is how do you feel about the art? I have two sub questions of this. What impact do you think using anthropomorphic characters has on the story? And how do you feel about the occasional references to copyrighted characters in the work? Did that add to or detract from your reading experience?
I think the copyrighted characters thing is occasionally a helpful signifier, just from a storytelling standpoint. I can't remember anyone other than the character who looks like Clifford, but in one of the comic book roundup reviews,
there's also a character that is very clearly Charlie Brown.
Yeah,
that maybe you didn't quite catch, but
I must have. Which character is it?
It was just like a side character that's like, but there are like,
oh, Clifford, is it the mechanic dude? I'm looking at this page right now. Is that who it is?
Yeah, he kind of looks like Charlie Brown. Up?
Okay, I see it now. I hadn't made that connection, but I do see this guy now being transphobe Charlie Brown.
Yeah,
I get it.
But okay. Yeah, like I don't know. Like I found I know like. Another book that I saw this kind of compared to, but I also, I guess, struggle a little bit with the comparison is Mouse. And like, I don't know, I find the use of like specific like images of copyrighted characters included in the work to be just sort of interesting. It adds to the sort of like the distance between the work and the real world in a way, but also like is part of the like contextualizing of everything. I don't know. I just think it's really interesting. So I was curious as to how that impacted both of your like reading experiences of the book. Like when there were occasionally these characters that are very clearly intended to be like characters from other comics.
I mean, I noticed it a couple times and then kind of brushed by it. It didn't occur to me that they might have either been trying to do something with that, or it was just sort of like, oh, that's funny. That's Clifford the Red Dog, or oh, that's transphobe Charlie Brown, like Jean-Luc said. It just kind of moving on.
Transphobe Charlie Brown.
It just seemed like silly little Easter eggs. I think the use of the anthropomorphic animals is almost a little more interesting because some of the characters are not. I know one of the persons, the main character, like hits over the head with a wrench is like a human. Some of the characters, yeah. Like there are random ones that are humans, and I'm guessing it's not actually random that yeah. There are reasonings. I just didn't like close read it enough to, you know, figure it out.
Sure.
I was thinking about that today, and there's two things that I had kind of thought. The first is kind of the surface level the characters that she's close to, that she knows well, are anthropomorphic animals, and then some of the sort of random background characters are humans. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the first person that she fucks in, like, the opening scene is a human, and then there's the transphobe Charlie Brown mechanic character is a human, and there's a couple other ones. Like, when she goes to the... when she goes to get tested for STDs, I think there are a couple characters who are human in the that are there. I also wonder if it's sort of a... I also thought that maybe it's sort of a... like, it's a metaphor for the signifier of, like, who the queer characters in the story are versus the non-queer characters.
I saw that, like, referenced in some reviews of the work, but I don't know that... I don't know if you go through that necessarily holds up, but
I do think
it's interesting.
It doesn't necessarily hold up if you just read the text, like, sort of what, like, just by what's on the page, because, like, the Clifford character who is her boss, and you know, she's kind of forced to come out to him in a meeting.
Well, I would like to contest the idea of forced, but we can get,
well, not forced, but it is the nature of, like, a labor situation that it is somewhat coerced, right?
Yeah,
you can argue the degree of coerced, of forced, I guess, but I think there is it's obviously it's necessarily a coercive relationship.
Well, I have complicated opinions about that scene specifically. Sure. We will get to that.
Okay. No, we can talk about them, but the point I was going to make is just that, like, he doesn't say that he's gay or queer or in any way, and he never shows up again. So there's no, like, textual confirmation that it happens.
Yeah.
But that's kind of why I think you have to look at... I think it, the way that reading makes sense is from a subtextual angle. Mm-hmm. Although, like, some of those characters you don't necessarily see enough of on the page to really... You can't say for sure, obviously, with some of them.
Sure.
Also, as I'm paging, I'm just sort of flipping through this digitally to try and find characters who are not anthropomorphized, and I just realized there's a Snagglepuss character.
Yeah, very good.
Which is very funny. I think this came out before the gay Snagglepuss comic
which is
I mean, obviously it's not that, like, you couldn't read Snagglepuss as gay before the Mark Russell gay Snagglepuss comic. But, like, I think this does predate that.
I believe I hadn't even picked up on that.
I hadn't even picked up on that until you mentioned that there were actual references to
gay characters.
But that's sort of my reading on it. I need to sit on it a little bit more to sort of figure out, like, to feel more confident in that reading of the anthropomorphized versus human characters. But that was kind of what the conclusion that I had come to.
I just thought it was interesting. I thought that it was, like, a fun, like, I don't know, like, you're obviously not gonna, like, if you're trying to tell, like, an original queer work, in a lot of, like, unless you are specifically hired to tell, like, the Snagglepuss gay comic, like, for the most part, there's only so much that you can do with that sort of idea. But, like, I liked that. I don't know. I liked the occasional inclusion of, like, random, obviously copyrighted characters, because I just thought it was fun.
Sure.
But I was curious if it, like, in any way, like, having those characters be, like, important parts of scenes, like, did that make it difficult for you with, like, reading or internalizing certain scenes or whatever, I guess is the question.
I would say I only noticed the obvious ones, and then, like I said, I kind of just breezed by it, thinking it was, you know, an Easter egg or a fun reference. So, it didn't really strike me much at all.
The reason I asked is because when I was looking at, like, Goodreads reviews of the comic, it did seem like there were a handful of people that were like, why is Clifford here? Why is Charlie Brown here? And I'm like, I don't fucking know. Like, why are you so concerned about
I do that? Appreciate that she mentioned Goodreads reviews, because she's given me a new place to look for cursed things that people say about these comics that I can spice up the episode with.
Yeah, like, the last thing I would recommend anybody do is go to Goodreads or Comic Book Roundup, because both of those sites are worthless.
Yes. I assume we are talking about Chad reading The Pervert for Comic Book Roundup. And I would like to hear about that.
No, I'm bitching about Comic Book Roundup as a hive of villainy and scum.
We are haters of comicbookroundup.com, you know. But we were just saying, because you missed it, that it has given me some. You mentioning Goodreads reviews has now given me something to farm to, like, spice up the episodes in the same way that, like, I feel like the Runaways forums has now put a fire in me that, like, I want to know what, like, weird internet people think about the comics that we read.
I do. So when I'm looking for stuff to talk about with books, I do often tap into the Goodreads.
See,
well,
and you've undersold yourself in the past, because you're always like, oh, I just look at Wikipedia and see what Wikipedia says.
For the most
you're doing more in-depth research. It's interesting. We gotta know what the people are saying.
I always go to TV Tropes.
TV Tropes is also good. Yeah.
I feel like it's harder for comics, but anyway, this is a tangent, a digression. I Emily, if you want to get back to the point you were making, I'm sorry.
No. I don't know. There was a specific point that I was making, other than I find this book very interesting, and I also find people's other thoughts on this book interesting.
I have to say that in the same way, and obviously it's not the same thing, but I respect Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey for just taking major IPs and running them through the gutter.
Uh-huh.
And I think The Pervert also does that, although it's a different, it's like a higher class of gutter. It's still like, you know, we're going to take these characters and put them in something that's really transgressive, but we're actually going to do it good, unlike the Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey movie. Yeah. The one other thing I was going to say about the anthropomorphic characters is that I think it's interesting for a book with so much sex, that some of which, like, obviously, like, you can't parse exactly what is autobiographical versus, like, what's fictionalized.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting part of the book. But, like, this is sort of based on, like, sex between real people, and I kind of find the sort of, I'm blanking on, I had a word in mind that I lost, but it does kind of muddy the waters a little bit that, like, the characters who are having sex are animals. And I think that's kind of interesting given something that the main character says towards the beginning, which is that, like, when she, because the main character is a sex worker, and when she goes to, you know, have sex with clients, she doesn't do it as a woman, even though she is a woman. She wears a binder and presents as a man.
Especially, like, early in the, like, I feel like you get to a point in the comic where she is doing sex work as a woman, just because there is not any other, like, part of her life where she is not a woman. So, like, I do find it incredibly interesting that, like, at least at the beginning, she has, like, a very substantial boundary there, and we do kind of see that, like, transgressed across the course of the book.
I mean, it shows a passage of time, right? As well as the a characterization change.
Yeah.
Because her hair grows as the comic goes on, too.
Yeah, yeah. And we will definitely talk about that for sure.
Yeah. I just think that layer of abstraction is kind of interesting, given, mm-hmm. like, that specific character beat that, you know, and obviously, again, like, it's not truly autobiographical, but even when, like, some of the stories are being told.
Semi-autobiographical.
Yeah. But then even when some of those stories are potentially being told, like, they're not told, there is a layer of abstraction that's still there, mm-hmm. which I think is interesting. And also, I mean, part of it is just that Remy Boydell draws a lot of furry art. Like, his other, I think he uses he/him pronouns. His other
comic, I was actually going to say, I have no idea what pronouns Remy Boydell
uses. His other book he's known for, 920 London, also uses anthropomorphized characters.
Yeah, and that's another book that I
think it
heard,
might be that simple, but
I've heard like complicated feelings about, but have not also read.
So. I haven't read it.
Maybe that'll make it to Pride Month volume 3.
Yeah. If we're still doing Pride Month in 2025.
Oh, fuck off. We're always going to be doing Pride Month. No, look, if I'm on the show, we're going to be doing Pride Month. that's how it goes.
Yeah. I can get behind that.
But yeah, I chose The Pervert because I had heard of it, and I am a fan of Remy Boydell's art, like, just sort of in general, and I knew that in the comics podcast you guys had read this book and enjoyed it, so I that definitely put it on my radar. But
it was the comics podcast best comic of 2018, the highly coveted award.
Oh, hell yeah.
I want to talk about the panel layouts. Because
it's in a very, like, the telling of the story is in a very, like, snapshots of moments, and that can kind of make for, I don't want to say difficult storytelling, but it can make for storytelling that is not as friendly to a reader necessarily, because it starts in media res, it drops you like in the middle of the story, and some of the scenes are told completely out of chronological order. So I find like the page layout and the like chronological payout to be interesting. So
the early pages of the comic, like the first 15 to 20, they have it's six panels kind of on a white page, and the pictures, the panels are, they remind me of like old Polaroids. Mm-hmm. Where they have a box on the bottom with text, and it's like explaining what's going on. And there's something just so kind of fascinating about the layout and like this storytelling method juxtaposed with what is going on. Like if you mm-hmm. opened up a bunch of Polaroids from a collection and they were people having sex and just like this matter of fact descriptions, or, you know, what was going through the main character's head, the mm-hmm. photo, you know, the person in the photograph's head while they were having sex, and it might not be related at all. Mm-hmm. It's I don't know if I want to call it like subversive exactly, but it's very, it like plays with expectations in such a way, because
people I would don't call take this pictures book that subversive.
Way. I guess, yeah, it is. And then the white background instead of the you know, any other color. There's just something like clinical and clean about just a white piece of paper, and then you have ostensibly smut overlaid it, but not just any smut, old Polaroids, as if you had a 30-year-old
camera.
Well,
we'll talk about the smut aspect for sure.
I just think it's a lot of really cool decisions that were made, because it feels very deliberate.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting to use, it just triggered something in my brain that it's interesting to use anthropomorphized characters and have all these references to, like, you know, Snagglepuss and Charlie Brown, and also to present it more like a newspaper strip almost than a mainstream, the way a mainstream comic is presented. It's an interesting, it is a really compelling design decision.
Yeah, I was wondering how, like, you felt about that, like, because it does, even though I did, like, you know, read this in one fell swoop, because on, like, I started reading it on Saturday and just, like, couldn't put it down because it's incredible. So, like, I did end up reading it, like, kind of all in one day. But, like, a lot of the, like, a lot of the aesthetic, a lot of the use of copyrighted characters, it gives it a, like, Sunday digest cartoon feel to it. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, because I also, growing up, I read a lot of newspaper comics and, like, newspaper serials. So that's a very, like, comfortable place for me to be.
Yeah. There's also the Polaroid point is interesting too, because there's so much that happens in the gutters between the panels, where, like, I mean, some of it is very much, like, obviously sequential. There are a few scenes where it's like this happens, then immediately after this happens. But yeah, there's some where it's like here's a shot, and then clearly the next shot is, like, multiple minutes after the first shot.
I
haven't thought about the Polaroid thing, but that is interesting in that context.
One of my questions was about how the vignette presentation of the book means that there are often events and changes with, like, characters and stuff that happen between scenes, between panels, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes, like, scenes in this comic are told, like, completely out of chronological order. So I was wondering, like, how you guys felt about that, how you felt about, like, how it impacted your read of the story.
I don't think it is. I mean, it goes back to that kind of dreamlike quality of the artwork, the slice of life nature to the story itself, where just things are happening and here are snapshots of how they're happening. Mm-hmm. There's a mundanity to a lot of what's going on, at least how it's presented, despite the subject matter not being mundane to the average person.
Sure.
And it just continues to, I don't know, like, it's another way it plays with expectations, where what you're reading is, it doesn't feel like what you're reading in a lot of ways. And I think I kept thinking about, like, work-life balance as I was reading this comic, and how if your work is sex work, how do you divorce that from, like, actual intimacy with people you care about versus clients, or when you're talking about work? Because, like, one of the things that most people do is they bitch about work. Like, what happened today? I talk about work all the time. And having your work overlap with normal things in life, like something like sex, that is, you know, this universal, intimate, you know, yada, yada, yada. I mean, it's not like I'm helping install a laser at work and then I'm going to come and do the same thing at home. Mm-hmm. But if I did, they'd probably throw me through a fucking loop, because, one, I'm not getting paid for it. And two, like, it's a different kind of stressful. And I feel like we almost see that a lot throughout this comic, is how this character really struggles to balance how she feels about sex from a transactional standpoint versus an emotional standpoint.
I feel like that really leads into a question that I had about this book, because there supposedly I found this sentiment coming up in a couple of interviews that I read with, like, Michelle Perez and Remy Bordell about the idea that the book is kind of a romance. But when I was reading this book, it definitely came across to me as, like, a book about like labor and like labor issues. And that seems to be part of the like intent of Michelle Perez in writing this book, because she like in between making this book happen also like worked in several factories, worked in like several instances where like she was obviously giving her labor in this sort of way, but also like the sex work is like another type of labor. And I find it incredibly fascinating that there are people who think that this is a romantic book, because I do, in my interpretation of this book and my reading of it this weekend before we recorded, is it is extremely a book about like how we sell our bodies for labor and like what that means. So I was just interested in like what the two of you thought about that as like a theme in this book.
I mean, yeah, it is. I'm surprised. It surprised me that people think of this as being a romance comic, for one.
I don't know that people say it's a romance, but that it like involves romance. And even sure. Then, like when I saw that, I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Chad hit the nail on the head in that, like, in the same way that, like, if you do your, like, doing your job is something that is, like, separate from your personal life and, mm-hmm. like, sex work. Like, I think that it is interesting that the way that this book is about how sex work kind of blurs the line more so than other jobs.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
And not just because of the sex, but because it's about it's intimacy in general, right? Like, the main character keeps coming back to this bit where, you know, you'll see her like in bed with a client, mm-hmm. and, you know, either making stuff up about her life or outright saying she doesn't want to talk about, you know, her life. I mean, there's that one recurring character, I think his name is Tom, the older guy.
Yeah.
He's like a consistent client. That one goes, obviously, like there's more there than just that.
Yeah.
But there are other times when it comes up in the comic as well. And then the way that that kind of, you know, prevents her from, you know, having intimacy, not prevents her obviously, but like makes intimacy in other contexts harder,
yeah.
is I think an interesting through line throughout the book.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
I get the impression that she tries to have intimate moments with people and just can't.
Yeah.
Like, she calls that one sex worker that lives across the pond who's getting ready to do mm-hmm. cam work. And, like, the first part of that conversation is, like, is this a client conversation or are we just talking? Like, there's always that barrier where, like, all the people in her life, it's not like she can just call them or talk to them and have a conversation. She has to, like, set these parameters first because her life is so messy that way. And then the stuff that doesn't need to be about sex winds up being about sex. And her girlfriend at one point was like, why is everything about sex with you? And it's like, I don't think that's the goal. I think it's just that's what happened.
Yeah.
Because of the what happened in her life and how she, you know, where she is in her life. And it makes the story really lonely. Like,
yeah.
This is probably one of the most lonely comics I have ever read, despite this character being surrounded by people and, like, moments that should be intimate, and like none of them are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of moments in this book that you would kind of expect to have a certain amount of intimacy that, like, they just don't.
Yeah, and she even shirks it in moments. I mean, obviously,
yes.
Like some, you know, the like. I get it, like, from a character perspective.
Yeah.
I think that conversation with the cam girl, I think, is one of my favorite moments in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, I do enjoy the pages that are sort of the back and forth between them having sex, and then the next page is like them getting paid
mm-hmm.
for it, and the page after that is like, you know, the guy crying. Like it's a very obvious progression there, right? Of mm-hmm. what the book is sort of saying about the main character, which I think is really well done. I mean, just in general, I mean, there's a lot of moments where the visual storytelling is really effective like that. But yeah, like it is fundamentally, I think, a book about like the things that you have to do when you're, you know, when you need to pay rent and buy food and in her case, you know, buy hormones and medication and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can't survive without it, and everyone is, well, the vast majority of people are on that treadmill to some extent. Like, obviously, yeah. It's different.
Yeah.
Like, but, you know, I think about politics a lot in my off time, and it's hard to you know, differentiate that from my actual job. But obviously, it's mm-hmm. different.
Yeah.
But still, like, you can't exist without working. And I think that's one of the things that, I mean, even for a long time, but even still, is like what makes being a queer person like really hard, is that it's much harder to operate in the formal labor market. I mean, yeah. It's hard for everyone to operate in the formal labor market because it's like,
but even
necessarily like biased against workers. But yeah, it's much harder because like she can't work in the factory without being harassed by her employees, right?
Yeah, like they don't have to know that she's trans in order to harass her.
Yeah, like you can call it's you know, they can call her the F slur because she's a, you know, she presents as a male with like long hair and more effeminate uh-huh. features, right? Like that, and that's the kind of thing that
I will say. I did for this recording, I did wear my shirt that says, "Are you man enough to be a fag? Ask yourself."
Good shirt.
It's a good shirt, yeah.
But yeah, like that, and you know, she eventually gets laid off from that job because, like, it not directly because, you know, she's trans, but, you know, there's the comment that she makes about, you know, there are people who are clearly way less competent than she was, and she was the one
who
lost her job.
There's there's a little bit of, like a self-destructive urge to... Like, or at least that was the feeling that I picked up on when she like comes out to her boss or yeah. like the guy like at her job where she like tries to tell him that she's trans, and it seems like she is hoping that this is gonna be like the nail in her coffin, and then it turns out that like the boss guy is actually like relatively cool, and that like is a complication, I guess. I found that to be very interesting.
It seemed like she was trying to tank her job and get fired yeah. for a bad reason so she could get like unemployment or something, but it's not really specifically stated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to get unemployment or whatever, like, you know, that's what you hope for if you're gonna get kicked off.
We've all tried to get fired from shitty jobs. I have been about as successful as her in my attempts to get fired from jobs I didn't like, unfortunately. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that is absolutely an element of it. Like,
mm-hmm.
everybody hates working in the formal labor market. And working in the informal labor market, you know, does seem like it has an allure, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
obviously, like, you know, there's... But it sort of comes with all its... with, you know... It definitely has its downsides, right? Because
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously, like she does it to a degree out of desperation, but then also like there's the whole thing where she talks about multiple times like the implicit threat of like, oh, this could go very badly, like on a sort of like balancing on a knife's edge.
Yeah, and, I mean, like, you know, like
her life is potentially in danger, right? So
in the beginning, she like kind of, she tries to refuse to do sex work as a woman because uh-huh. like there's like that, like there's that boundary there. But as she gets farther into her transition, that is not as sustainable.
Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. Ugh.
Yeah. The main character is obviously transitioning throughout the story, but this is shown mostly through subtle cues, such as like the character growing out their hair, or like there's talk about like the impact of hormone replacement therapy on like her skin, et cetera, et cetera. Ostensibly asking to cis people on this call, but like how did you guys feel about like that approach to addressing a character being transgender? Because that's also like normally when a character is trans in anything, there's like the coming out story, and then the like starting hormones or whatever, and it's all very textbook, but this is very like, this feels slightly more in line with like, I don't know, real life to me. And I was just curious as to how you guys felt about like the progression of the character and like the obvious transition, but without like actually like out and out saying that's what is like, you know, even though like there's not, when I say without the out, like they're not hiding the idea that this character is transitioning, but it's also not like someone looking at the camera and saying, I'm taking hormones.
There's no moment where she comes out.
Yeah, there's not a coming out moment. Like we're meeting this character very clearly after she has come out and is like beginning hormones, but we see her through like the journey of like where she is clearly starting her hormone therapy versus like actually being able to like almost live. Like
it's organic visual storytelling throughout the story, which is, I mean, ultimately what I want out of any kind of story, mm-hmm. especially a comic book, like the more you can show without telling, the better you are at storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's a mundanity to it, as you know, as things progress, then so does she, as far as how she dresses, how she mm-hmm. tries to appear, because you can't like speed run transition. It takes a while for the hormones to do their thing, and you just kind of gotta to deal with it as it goes.
Yeah.
And I feel like we get that here. It also, it doesn't feel like there's ever an end goal. And
yeah,
that's also true to form too. Like the end goal ultimately would be to just like, oh, I have transitioned, but my life hasn't really changed. Mm-hmm. It has, but it hasn't. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like you're trying to stop, you know, an evil wizard from taking over, you know, a kingdom or whatever. Like this isn't like a fantasy story with a very deliberate arc. It's still a slice of life, and so her transition is treated like a slice of life element.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it works really well. Like I said, like organic is probably the best word I can use mm-hmm. to describe it.
Yeah, it's definitely an organic unfolding here.
I agree with Chad. I also think that there's an interesting thing from a coloring perspective, which is that in the back half of the book, there are definitely more moments where like the colors of the trans flag get evoked.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's the scene where she's sitting on the bus wearing a pink shirt, and her skin is white, and the seat that she's sitting on is blue. Mm-hmm. There's a scene like, I don't know, maybe like one or two vignettes later where she's in a diner and she's, again, her skin is white. She's wearing a blue dress. They're sitting on pink, mm-hmm. Like diner lounge chairs,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that comes up a couple times, like sort of closer to the end of the book, whereas earlier on it's not as, there's also in the back half there's also the dream sequence where she's mm-hmm. in she's in like, I think it's a pink skirt and a blue top,
mm-hmm.
But like earlier on in the book there's not as much of that. I mean, the coloring throughout is like really vibrant, I think, and it's very effective for from a storytelling standpoint,
mm-hmm.
But I do think it's interesting how as the book progresses, you start seeing that, which is something that is like very obvious, like evoked a lot more frequently, whereas you don't see it at the beginning. In the beginning, there's a lot more muted colors. It's a lot more of her, like, you get images of like her body, and they're like sort of, they're not exactly grayscale or black and white.
Sure.
But there are moments that are more muted. And those sort of, you know, they kind of change form more than completely go away. But by the end, it's more like the blues than the
grays.
You still see the grays from here and there. But I do think that that's an interesting note visually as well.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. How did you guys feel about the end of this book?
It's kind of bad.
I mean, I know that it's, I don't want to say like controversial, because I don't know that I have like I don't know that I've asked enough people to qualify it as controversial, but I know that between like Chad and our mutual friend Alice, and just like reading some stuff about the way that the ending of this book was received, I know that it's a little controversial.
And calling it bad is probably going a little far. Like, I don't know if I have that strong of an opinion about it.
Sure.
But like the back third, it almost feels like the story realizes it needs to come to some kind of climax or conclusion.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't know what to do with that. And so we start seeing more of the self-destructive nature of the character show up,
mm-hmm.
which is fine because it's never not there, mm-hmm. but it's leaned into kind of a weird way. Like, she's having conversations with ostensibly people that, like, her roommate or her friends, and is talking about, like, what it was like to live in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And they're so aghast. And it's like, it feels like them learning she used to live in some backwater place and hunt deer is what ruined the friendship. And it's treated so bizarrely. And it's like, what? I don't understand why we get like a 3 or 4 pages about like the horrific attitude that people have towards backwater Michigan. And don't get me wrong, I live in the Midwest. There are some shitty places in the Midwest, and she probably comes from one of them. But there are better ways to convey that than what happens. And then she ultimately has to go back home because she can't afford to live in Seattle. And that, I get that, like, her goal is to live in Seattle, fully transition, socially transition, and if she comes home, she feels like she can't do those things. I don't know if that's entirely true. I mean, like, she meets her father in the last couple panels, and she still has, like, long hair, and they hug. Like, it seems like her father is glad to have her back in mm-hmm. some way. And so it makes you wonder, like, how estranged the relationship actually was. And I think there are interesting things at play in the end that should have been seeded earlier on, and it would have felt a lot more cohesive. Or if, I don't know, I just, it's not that I don't like the ending, it's just I think it's not executed well, is maybe a better way to put it.
Yeah, I will agree that I think there is a part of me that understands what the story is trying to go for when the topic of like animal hunting comes up. But at the same time, I can understand the, like, because this is an anthro comic, like that feeling kind of weird that it seems like it comes out of nowhere. And, you know, not that it, when I say that, I do think that it kind, not that it comes out of nowhere, but it does, like, it does seem to be sort of like a weirder, bigger issue, and then
it feels like a break in the world building, because
it's
you
like
see the hunt, and it's a normal ass deer. It's not like it's an anthropomorphic deer, like they're not cannibals.
It's a weird part of the world building, and it is more significant in some of the interactions that she has later than I maybe anticipated.
I mean, maybe it's clunkily deployed, but it is an extension of the metaphor of the anthropomorphic characters. She's not the thing that's horrifying them isn't that, like, the deer are hunted and killed. It's that, like, that's why I think the reading the anthropomorphic characters as being queer kind of is, like, it is kind of the quote-unquote correct reading, because, like, that's my impression of, like, what they're actually talking about
at yeah.
the
end of
the book. Is that, like, and I'm, is that, like, not that, I mean, obviously it's not necessarily super literal all the time, but, like, that, you know, it is, it can be dangerous for, you know, a trans woman to live in a lot of parts of the Midwest, especially, you know, 10 years ago.
I mean,
maybe even more so now.
But. Well, and I, part of the metaphor that, like, part of the metaphor that I found interesting was, like, because I know for people like Chad and I, that, like, hunting animals is sort of like, it's sort of a bog standard part of life for people that we have, like, grown up with and grown around.
Well, and yeah, I mean, me too. My grandparents have hunted for as long as I've
been. Well, sure, but you, I feel like, John Luke, you also maybe have, like, a slightly different perspective here, because even though you grew up, you know, like, in the Midwest and stuff, and your grandparents hunt, like, your parents don't do that. Like, that was not something that you were raised with on, like, an interpersonal level. Like, even though, like, because of Southern misogyny, I was never part of the hunting specifically. Like, it's still, like, the killing and butchering of animals for meat, et cetera, is, like, still very much, like, a part of something that I was aware of tangentially, even if I was not directly involved. But, like, you grew up vegetarian. Both of your parents were vegetarian. Yeah. So, like, I don't know, I
still grew up around it. Like, I mean, my grandparents have, like, my grandpa has, like, the heads of deer he's shot mounted in his
sure, yeah. House. So does mine.
I'm not unfamiliar with the psychotic behavior of Midwestern hunters.
Well, okay, like,
I love my grandparents.
But, you know, like, not necessarily the unfamiliarity with the behavior, but maybe like a perspective on it that is slightly more that it is psychotic.
Well, I mean, sure, I do have that perspective, and I think that's a.
Yeah, I was just making that like in contrast to, like, maybe Chatter.
Yeah, absolutely, but I think that's like for a lot of people who live in urban, like in cities, who tend to be more liberal, more like whatever you want to call it, like. It is horrifying to hear about it, right? Like,
well, that's kind of
not
what
so
I was...
much for people who aren't vegetarian, but I get it. Like, I've lived in big cities for, like, the last decade of my life. Most of my friends live in and grew up in big cities. Like, you know, it is obviously a very different perspective on it. And so maybe I'm just more understanding of, like, why they're horrified, and then when you sort of combine that with the
well,
metaphor,
that was more what I was trying, kind of trying to get at, is like the concept of, like, maybe, like, when she is in Seattle, like, there are maybe more people for whom, like, the idea of hunting and that sort of thing is not necessarily as normal. Yeah, I'm making some assumptions about Seattle, because I know that there are, like, plenty of
people hunt in Washington.
There are plenty of people in Washington that hunt and the like. But, like, when you start getting to areas like Seattle or, like, Portland, Oregon, where you maybe have less people that don't that I don't know. I find the concept of, like, people in the main character's life being horrified by the hunting. I guess part of my attempt to, like, also meet that where it is, like, wondering if her being in Seattle might impact the way that people received the idea of her, of like her being involved in hunting and stuff. Like, does that make
sense? It just seems, it seems like a contrived plot point. Like, there's maybe something to be said there because culturally, yeah, the Midwest in Michigan is going to be very different from Seattle, and I'm guessing a lot of ways. But to me, it just struck out as a really weird narrative misstep to.
But I'm wondering how contrived. I'm wondering how contrived it comes across, like in more proper context, like, or
I mean, people from Seattle who eat meat have to understand that it's got to come from somewhere.
I feel like you're. I feel like you're making a very broad stroke when you say that. But also,
no, I do think I think Chad's point is reasonable, and I also think that like the hunting thing is not like the hunting, the way she talks about hunting is sort of stacked on top of everything else, because it's not just that. Like immediately before she has that conversation about hunting, there's the whole bit about how she like has kind of stopped eating, and you know, we see that she has like some kind of a violent streak earlier on in the book, where she like, you know, there's the homeless guy who asks for her donut, and she like threatens to beat the shit out of him, and then she does like beat the shit out of the mechanic. Like, did the mechanic guy deserve it? Like, sure. Like, I will absolutely grant you that it like was probably cathartic to hit that guy with a wrench. Yeah. You know, but like she does have there is stuff that is seeded, I think, earlier in the book about how, I don't want to say that she's like toxic or anything like that, because I think like that is such a vague word anyway, but like she is very clearly going through a lot between working, being a sex worker, and her transition, and it makes her emotional state somewhat volatile, which we see kind of repeated throughout the series a couple times. And so like in that context, again, like I do agree that it sort of comes out of nowhere, and it is kind of disconcerting that like the mouse character she's talking to at the end, this is the first time we've seen her in like 100 pages, and the previous time was like them talking about burgers and joking and being super conversational and friendly. It does feel weird that like all of a sudden she's like completely like turned off and seemingly disgusted.
Yeah.
But there's also a sense. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
There's sort of the elephant in the room is the book is called The Pervert, but it's raising the question of like, what do we consider perverse? Because that mouse character, I mean, their conversation is like, hey, we should fuck this hamburger, which is to the layman a very perverse conversation. And then she's talking about, oh, yeah, we had to gut the deer and hang them and the blood would drain so we could, you know, get the meat off them. And I mean, I've had that conversation a lot living in the Midwest because I know so many people will hunt. Like, there's nothing perverted about that conversation to me because it's a part of life here. But because it's not a part of life there, that's considered perverse, whereas, you know, banging a hamburger is just funny. And I think it's probably trying to make a point about that, and like what we consider taboo, what we consider bad is a little arbitrary, a little bullshit, and then ultimately with what our social circles come up with.
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfectly valid thing to make for this comic. I just have umbrage with how it's done.
Sure.
No, that's fair. And I also agree with you that I'm anti-Michigan slander. But, you know, as, you know, being from Michigan, I love Michigan. But also I understand that it's about more than just the...
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, the deer is a metaphor, kind of, for her life. And, like, there's a lot wrapped up in going back to Michigan. But also, I think that it's honest in a sense, too, that, like, if you move past the deer... I guess I don't know how you guys feel about, like, the end, like, beyond the deer thing. But, like, that does feel, like, kind of honest that, like, you know, lots of people have lots of dreams about living in big cities. And I think that goes to the labor and exploitation point that, like, you can't just coast and live in big cities. And it's fucked up that that's the way it is because of like how expensive like the cost of living is.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about the ending of this book is that in another chat that Chad and I are in, Chad, you described the ending of this book as like the character possibly, and I you said detransitioning. I don't feel like that accurately describes what happens, but I want to make sure that I'm like accurate to the way that you reacted to this. But yeah, like the ending involves the character reconnecting with her dad, who she is presumably either like, if she is not out to, like there is a contentious relationship there. But I like bristled at the idea that she is detransitioning less than maybe like, I don't know, like putting a, like a pause. We don't even know, like she could still theoretically be getting her hormones in Michigan. We just don't, we don't really know how that plays out after she moves back. But I thought it was interesting that you, Chad, interpreted the ending as her like attempting to like step back from transition by moving back in with her dad. Am I correctly so, interpreting what you said, or?
Yeah, I guess I thought there was a line somewhere in the comic where she actually said if she had to go back, that would mean detransitioning.
I may have also missed that. Is the
she does say that earlier on in the
sure? I just didn't like. I don't know, like at the point that she's at when she reaches the end, I wasn't sure that that was still true. It felt more like that was a fear, but also right. You know, and that's it's hard to possible. Say.
I think largely her going back, it's more of the metaphor of the story as is like literally going backwards. It's uh-huh. not like going to a new place that was home. It's undoing everything, because her time in Seattle, it feels like she's trying to progress to a specific point that she wants to mm-hmm. hit, and leaving Seattle and having to move back with her dad, who she has some definitely strange relationship with, based on it is a setback. And because there's not a lot of narrative stakes in this would make the most narrative stake sense, is like, oh, going back is literally going back in every sense uh-huh. of the word. Now, whether it's true or not remains to be seen. The fact that her dad hugs her and you know, she still has long hair, and the scene is kind of sweet, and it seems
it's a
like,
little ambiguous.
You know, you can, it's ambiguous. And
the ending enough time in itself happened. Is very ambiguous.
I think right. it's only somewhat ambiguous because of the line about like a life ending in Seattle. Like I kind of agree with, like, I also agree with Chad's interpretation, I think, of the ending to a certain extent. But yeah, it is definitely open. Like, it doesn't say it outright, but I think that is the implication of like the way that she's dressing at the end mm-hmm. and the final like monologue that she has about, you know, sort of being confined to Michigan. Like, you know, it that is sort of what I felt like the story was.
Well, and that's also like when you look at cases of people detransitioning, like there are plenty of cases of people who like attempted gender transition and it just simply was not the right choice for them. But the overwhelming majority of times when people detransition, it's because like transition is really difficult and sucks and is hard. Most of the time when people detransition, like they will, if they get to a point in their lives where they are in a place where they can comfortably transition, they will like start again. So I don't know.
I agree with that. I think that that's absolutely, that applies to this character.
Yeah.
For sure.
It
goes back to the labor thing, right?
Yeah. I, I guess I was struck by like Chad's use of the term detransition, because I get like, for me, my interpretation of this was like, she's gonna probably go back in the closet for a little while before she can get back on her feet. And I guess maybe like, for some people that could count, like that could qualify as detransition, but I don't know.
I mean, obviously it sets off a lot of alarm bells, because you think about the, you know, three losers that like right wingers were.
Yeah, absolutely.
As proof that like transitioning is bad, sure, or whatever. But I think that it's there are gray areas.
Yeah.
And I think that like a lot of this book is about that,
yeah,
right? Like, Alex, what do you think about the pervert?
Yeah, Alex, I want to know what you think about the pervert, because you only just joined an hour in.
I've been sitting here in silence for the past hour. You guys just said everything. That was really good. I like it. I think I think it's a very strong, you know, coming of age somewhat story, but also like the way it uses the, you know, the John Arbuckle scene kind of sticks in my head as like, it's funny and then it's like disturbing, and I think that's like a great way used throughout it, where it doesn't take away and sometimes it's like adds to the comedic, mm-hmm, effect. The ending, I didn't read it like I guess Chad and Jean-Luc did. I mean kind of sort of, but like I feel like it's not always just a okay, everything's gonna be great, you know, I've transitioned, it's done. I feel like it's an ongoing,
yeah,
thing in their lives, where like I feel like it's like, it's not, and I think I was reading something about it, but it's not so much an optimistic book, but it's like a loving book, where it's like it wants the character to be, mm-hmm, okay, and that journey's not always just like, obviously not easy, but also it's not necessarily like, I think the fact that it's ambiguous at the end is good, because a lot of people did different journeys where like, hey, some people actually, you know, went through with this, some people did, and it's like, just because, you know, your journey might be a little different at the end doesn't mean that it's any less valuable.
Some people go through like various stages of like transition and what that means, and like discovering your identity, and that was kind of more like that was a little more what I got from, I guess, like the ending is very sad and it made me very sad, but I don't know. In the end, I still felt kind of hopeful.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Because the thing is sad, and it's very clearly some kind of setback. I mean, that is the narrative structure we're going for, and how it's set up. But ultimately, her life in Seattle doesn't seem like it's going that great either.
Yeah, I mean, she is literally starving.
She's literally starving. A lot of her friends are leaving or abandoning her for various reasons. Her job is dangerous. I mean, you know, that comes up a handful of times, that sex work is a dangerous job, and it's not like the police are going to help you, because what you're doing is technically illegal. And so it's like, yeah, she moves back and that's a setback, but ultimately she's young enough where this could be a good thing in the long run. We just, mm-hmm, don't know. And it's an open ending and it's unsatisfying, and it, as much as I don't like unsatisfying endings in work, because why would you like them? It makes sense for this story in this context, the slice of life nature, like, you know, day-to-days are just day-to-days, and that's ultimately what the story is. And so it fits. And eventually, baby, she'll go on to have a chunk of her life where there's more good day-to-days than bad day-to-days, but it's always going to be just that day-to-day thing, that the mundane and how she relates to the mundane experiences, because that's what it is.
There is a part of me that does wish that, because there is she has the character who is a client of hers who like had a trans woman partner who passed away, and so he kind of like fulfills this need through sex workers, and he does, before she leaves, like, he does offer her like the possibility of like, we don't have to be together, but you also don't have to go back to Michigan. And there's a part of me that like really like in my heart wants for like her to have said yes to that and to embrace like the security that this guy wanted to offer her. But like at the same time, like, even if he is offering her security, like, she has no way of knowing like how sustainable that's going to be, like whether or not, like,
that's functionally the same as your job.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just the, like
my job gives me sustainability, but I don't want to like, I don't want to rely on that forever, because if my job like randomly fires me,
exactly,
tomorrow, like, I can't
like there, there's always like, even if she were to take the security that he is offering her, like, there's always the possibility that, like, this is going to be something that is held over her head in the way that a lot of things have been held over her head throughout her whole life. But I don't know. It's a complicated feeling, and it just makes me sad.
There's something, like, really compelling about that relationship, because ultimately it's two different people filling two different voids, and it's none of it's healthy. Like, it's self-destructive, just in a much slower rate of descent. I don't think it would have worked long-term. I don't know what the dangerous implications could have been if they were living together for more than, you know, a couple hours or a night. I think it's something I wish the story maybe had seeded more, so we could, you know, be a little more determined that, hey, this was not a viable solution. For more reasons than kind of some of the nebulous, obvious ones. And it goes back to, the story starts off as slice of life. I think it was supposed to run differently, maybe for longer, and then it couldn't. And then the last third, it had to end. And it, you can kind of feel that chink, that ka-chunk, you know, as it goes from one mode to another. It's like, oh, well, now we're a trade paperback. We have to have some kind of climax. This is what it's going to be. And it doesn't, a lot of things don't feel either built up appropriately or earned. And that's my issue with the ending.
Yeah, like it was originally intended to run in Islands, like just until it reached its end. And then Islands shut out, like shuttered before this story did reach its end. So they kind of had to go more of a graphic novel, like,
right, and I'm just saying it to me, it shows that is what happened.
I don't know. Again.
Yeah, I absolutely do. I agree with that. It does feel like.
Do we know the exact point where it, like, reached in?
I can tell you if you give me a couple minutes. I think we lost Emily again. I'm scrolling through this issue of Island. Boo, 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 boo. What's this? Wait, did everyone freeze or am I?
No, I'm still here. I can hear you.
Oh, okay. I think Emily just froze up. Okay, good.
Yes.
These Island issues are like 150 pages. So,
oh, geez. Are you just going one by one?
Yeah, I'm just scrolling. Oh. I dropped off Island before the pervert started.
Oh, you're reading it. That's cool.
Appearing. Well, I read the first like 10 issues of it. Island was a very cool series for the record. It was like an anthology series that it started off with like
a, I'm here.
Great. It started off with like a bunch of sort of big creators. Like, I think Kelly Sue DeConnick wrote for it at first.
Hmm.
It sort of transitioned into having more of a focus on lesser known, in particular, international and queer creators. And then it turned out that Brandon Graham, who was the guy who sort of, Island was his brainchild. It turned out that he was a creep and a piece of shit.
Oh,
and
didn't
so
know that.
Nobody
sucks.
Wanted to work with him. And Island had other, I mean, there were other issues with like the publication model of like having to rely on a bunch of different creative teams to release a series consistently. You know, like not always the, you know, it's not always going to result in a consistent release schedule. So there were issues with it before, but it was a really cool anthology series while it was running. It looks like last... it looks like it did not get very far in Ireland. The last bit that was published in Ireland is from issue 13, and it's issue 12. So and it only was in Ireland for I believe two or three issues of Ireland, and it wasn't like full issue size. So it did not get particularly close to the ending.
It's very possible that...
No, not at all.
But they probably had some more... They had some written ahead of time, and then they probably just never made it into the magazine.
Actually, the John Arbuckle joke is the last vignette that appears in Ireland. But yeah. Anyway, okay. we should maybe look towards wrapping up. We've gone a little long.
My last question is... Because everyone can see in the notes... Does this book count as furry porn?
No.
Yes.
Oh, maybe.
Thanks, folks.
I feel like we're getting a real range of
responses. Well, it's certainly pornographic, and the characters are anthropomorphic animals. So I like.
Yeah, I would. I am inclined to stand in the place where John Luke is that. This is a book that contains furry characters, and it is, by definition, pornographic because it does include depictions of sex acts without very much in the way of censoring.
But it is not porn in the sense that you're supposed to jack off to it.
Agreed.
No. I would understand if there are people who would not classify it as furry porn because it is not made with the intention.
Let's just say I won't be reading this during my next session with the power vacuum.
Sure, thank you.
Our sponsor, HVAC. Thank you. That's great.
But no, I just put that question in because I thought it was funny. And also, like... without getting into a topic that will draw out the length of this recording, I find it fascinating the way that people react to media that involves anthropomorphic animal characters, the like stigma surrounding quote-unquote furry content and how that impacts the way people receive things like this, because I did, when I was looking at like Goodreads reviews, I saw people like, even though they were praising the book, like being weird about the fact that it's animal characters, and I'm like, I don't know, man, like why is it, I don't know, like it, I guess this comes from me having the perspective of being someone who is like, I wouldn't consider myself involved with furry fandom, but I am like tangentially like associated with, and I enjoy like furry content to a degree. And I find the way that people react to furry or like anthro adjacent content to be kind of fascinating, because it's like nobody is worried about whether or not they're enjoying like the fox what is the fucking Robin Hood, the Fox Robin Hood movies made by Disney, like when they're kids, but then they become an adult and it's like, oh, like it's suddenly weird for me to enjoy things that involve anthro characters because furries are weird to me, an adult person. I don't know. I'm losing my thread here, I find it interesting the way that people react to this book because it has anthro characters.
Yeah.
I feel like this comic could be more uncomfortable if it didn't.
I agree. I think it makes it just, you can have it to a wider audience and take it in. I mean, like,
I'm going to go on a limb and say I don't like watching animals having sex. But that's, you know, just me.
But they're not. But they're not.
Yeah, no, I know.
Like, they are. Like, they are humanoid.
Yeah. I think it's a weird thing to, like it's not, just I guess, critique or complain about, like, oh, there's, like, furries in this, and then not mention, like, oh, there's, like, Charlie Brown, who's, like, Mickey Mouse, or, like, John Arbuckle, who's, like, popping out, and like, I want a threesome, and it's, like, what?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But people are scared of furries, so.
Yeah, I don't, I find it. I find it fascinating the way that people are scared of furries and that people, like, want to try to distance themselves from association with
cowards,
furries.
Cowards, all of them.
Yeah, no, I agree. But that was my real reason for including the question, does this count as furry porn? Because I guess, like, it is pornographic. It does contain anthro characters. So by definition, it is furry porn. But it is also not, it's not a porn comic.
It's not what people think,
like,
of
it's
when
just
they
a comic that happens
porno.
To
yeah,
involve
it's not like,
sex.
I feel like it's not like, oh, it's a furry porn comic. If you say that about this comic and people read it, they're like, this is not what I expected. And it's like, well, yeah.
Yeah, like, I feel like there are a lot of comics without furry characters that include a lot of sex that you, like, if you describe this as a porn comic, people would be like, what are you talking about? But, like, because there's, like, an inherent idea of furry as, like, sexually transgressive, like anything that involves like anthro characters that is also like not safe for work, whatever that means. I don't know. Anyway, I find it interesting.
I feel like to me, porn has to have the intention to be titillating, and that isn't what this is. Mm-hmm. We're like, if you look at something like Sunstone, despite being much less explicit in its depictions. Sunstone wants to be titillating. Like, it started off on DeviantArt. To me, Sunstone is pornographic, and this is not, despite there being more genitals shown in this.
Yeah, like, there are plenty of scenes in this book that involve, like, full nudity of various characters, but and even in sexual acts, but I would hesitate to refer to it as, like, porn.
I wouldn't, but you know, that's, you know, maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I would, if someone were like asking me about this comic, I would say that it like contained content that they should be like, you know, like aware of, but I agree with Chad's stance that like, If for something to be pornographic, by definition, it should also be, like, with the intention to titillate. And there's just, not, like none of the scenes in this comic strike me as, like, intention to titillate.
That's fair. That's fair.
Like, they are sexual, and they are sexually explicit, but I would not say that they are titillating.
And speaking of not titillating, we should head into the cry space.
What's that?
Sure should. You guys... Oh, what?
What's that sound?
Oh, I didn't
What's
do
the sound?
I'm sorry. It's the doomsday clock. It's the cry space.
Wait, do you guys hear the sound? The sound of the doomsday clock? I have... unless anyone else wants to go first, I do have locked and loaded a cry space for this episode. My cry space for this episode is that I was bullied by a child, and I'm going to explain the circumstances of this. I went for a normal walk around my apartment complex grounds this morning, and as I was walking around, a child began to yell at me, "Billie Eilish! Billie Eilish, can I get a picture?" And I have not recovered in the 12 hours since wow. this occurred. And I shouldn't, there's a part of me that says, you should not have admitted this embarrassment to the podcasting listenership, but that's not how podcasting works.
Let the kid know you weren't Billie Eilish, or did you sign the autograph?
I did not acknowledge him at all. I simply walked on by. And as I couldn't have been older than 13 if I had to guess. I'm very bad at being able to tell children's ages, but this was definitely could not have been older than a preteen.
Damn. Billie Eilish snubs fans again. Classic.
Oof. Right.
What a
yeah,
fucking moron.
I just kept on walking and pretended like I didn't hear him, but it was devastating. Because
Billie Eilish only dies her roots. She doesn't dye everything.
She only has like as far as like the green hair Billie Eilish look goes, like she has like neon green roots, and then like the rest of it is dark hair, which is the exact opposite of what I have going on. So like I said, devastating own by a child living near me.
I want to buy that kid a chocolate.
Now everyone else gets to tell me why. Now everyone else gets to tell me why they cried.
Fine, I'll go next. Thanks, to Chad. Move this fucker along. I got to see the Northern Lights this weekend for the first time.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
Which,
I didn't. I was too eepy.
Was a very magical, you know, it felt like once-in-a-lifetime experience. And I didn't get, like, the best look at them, but last night for, like, 5 minutes, and I had to get a picture, like, I could see the green kind of shimmering stuff in the sky, and it was like, oh my God, there they are. That's
the Billie Eilish.
That's them.
In the sky.
It was really cool. I was really happy to see that. It was nice.
I'm glad you got to catch it.
I wish I had gotten to see them. I did not. I think there's simply too much light pollution.
Why was everyone hyping up?
There was too much light pollution where I am, and I didn't stay up long enough for it to be visible.
I'm disappointed that everyone is hyping up the solar eclipse, which is like, oh, cool, you can see that thing. And then, like, the cooler thing, it was, like, a last minute. Yeah. By the way, it's, like, happening right now. And it's like, what? What do you mean?
I agree. This is way cooler than the eclipse.
Oh, yeah.
My cry space is not a cry space. My cry space, every other cry space will be replaced for the coming 12 months by a review of the new Coheed and Cambria comic, No Go to Apollo, I'm Burning Star 4.
Oh, I got my
volume card. 2, No World for Tomorrow.
I have waited
decades for the release of the No World for Tomorrow comic, and issue number 1 came out earlier this week. Of course, by the time this comes out, it'll be a little outdated, but, you know. It is, sure. You know, in classic Claudio Sanchez, Chandra Eckert style, let's say it's not the greatest comic book of all time. The art is gorgeous, actually. They got a good artist for this one, which is exciting. And unfortunately, it just simply starts on like a boatload of exposition because it has been 8 years since...
a bunch of exposition in a Coheed comic?
But the back half has some goated stuff where the protagonist, who has the same name as the lead singer of the band, cries about his dead girlfriend in the comic. As always, it is just beautiful to see Claudio Sanchez's self-insert character written by his now wife. I find that to be a lot of fun. So
it's what Claudio deserves.
It's good. I enjoyed the back half of the comic quite a bit, but it's not the best first issue, I would say.
I enjoyed the new song.
Yeah, there is a new song.
I'm a fan of the joke. I had not actually listened to Deranged. Yeah. And
you should listen. Deranged is
good. No, I have now. Okay. But I had not previously, and I also enjoyed
Deranged. Rocks.
So excited to see. Excited to keep up with these updates from Coheed Nation.
Well, I'm here representing it. I'm sorry to the audience and my co-hosts. Alex, you have something?
I almost got into an altercation with like a 35-year-old man at a soccer game because he was like, he was like, Adam, you know, my brother Adam.
Very American of you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he probably felt safer getting an altercation in Canada because there was no chance whipping out a gun.
And if he does, it's honestly respect. You did it. I can't do anything. That's fine. Adam and him collided, and then the guy was like, "Oh, why'd you hit me?" And I was like, "Oh, calm down." And he's like, "You want to fight?" And I was like, "What? What is this? What is this? This is rec league soccer. What is this?" But my real cry space is Space Ghost Coast to Coast. I think it's 2 weeks in a row, two episodes in a row. It's still airing on YouTube, and it's, you know, all these episodes going. But I haven't been able to catch the one with Charlton Heston in the last week and a half, and that's my favorite.
Not
one.
Not yet.
Damn. Which Charlton Heston comes on the show, and he's talking about, like, in Planet of the Apes, something you didn't know, the apes sat in one area for lunch, and the chimpanzees sat in another area for lunch. And the humans, and then while that's going on, Zorak's going, nah, for like a minute and a half. And Charlton Heston is like actually flustered as this is going on.
I've actually never seen the Charlton Heston
episode. It's so good.
He gives up his Academy Award.
I'm very excited.
And then Space Ghost is listening to a self-improvement tape that tells him to blow up the Hoover Dam. And he blows up the Hoover Dam, and then he gets arrested at the end. So
yeah, I love the bit about Space Ghost running out of punch in the parties that he throws for himself in his head. it's very good.
It's a great episode.
Also, very fitting to watch Charlton Heston episode this week when the new Planet of the Apes just came out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
I think that'll do it.
Chad, did you have a cry space? I was making sure
thanks
we
for
all
having me on the show, guys.
Thanks for doing this, Alex.
Special guest, Alex. Yeah, now that we have ended our cry space, it is time for the plugs. If you would like to follow this show on the internet, you can do that at Crying Book Club on Twitter. You should rate and review us 5 stars on your podcasting platform of choice. You can find Jean-Luc Botville on Twitter at Mountain Dew Liker. You can find him on Letterboxd at JL Botville. Alex, you can find on Twitter at Alex Hansiak. I can be found on Twitter at mpandanata, Letterboxd Pandabore, Twitch Pandabore Podcasts, Imagine Me and You Should Know, the Fresh Podcast Market, and That Looks Terrible. And Chad can be found on Twitter at InonymBand. The podcast opinions are cheap. Writing can be found on anonym.wordpress.com. Music can be found on anonym.bandcamp.com. And you can search for his books on Amazon as Chad Waller. And that is the end of our show, which means it is time for the end theme song that we all know and love.